Welcome to No Filter, a skincare podcast featuring the good, the bad, and the unfiltered. Hosted by myself, Courtney Adams.
And me, Griffin Churchwell.
Today on No Filter, it's a solo episode, so it's going to be just me, Griffin, interviewing my boss, Dr. Mary Gengras, board-certified plastic surgeon. So I had a lot of questions for her about her history with plastic surgery. She's a third-generation plastic surgeon, so I had questions for her about why she wanted to go into it. We talked a little bit about the history of plastic surgery. She answered a lot of surgery and filler questions. And we talked a lot about breast health. So here is the interview, and I hope everyone enjoys. So thank you, Dr. Gengras, for sitting down with me and being on my podcast. I'm really excited to have you here. I have some questions for you about, I'm really curious. So you're a third generation plastic surgeon. So your grandfather was a plastic surgeon.
Yes, that's true.
What kind of surgeries was he doing?
So he was initially a dental student, so he went to dental school and then decided that he wanted to go to medical school. And so he put himself through medical school teaching anatomy to the dental students. And this is all at Marquette in Wisconsin, where I grew up. And so when he became an MD, so at that point he was an MD, DDS, he went primarily into maxillofacial surgery, which is surgery above the clavicle, mostly head and neck, a lot of cranial reconstruction, a lot of war wounds, cancer reconstructions, things like that. So he was using his dental degree to become super specialized as a surgeon.
And that's really interesting because I had read that about the history of plastic surgery. People don't realize you think plastic surgery and you think breast implants because they're so prevalent. But really the roots of it are in reconstruction from World War I and II. That's the roots of it, right?
Absolutely. It really was and still is called plastic and reconstructive surgery. I mean, my boards say plastic and board certified in plastic and reconstructive surgery. And aesthetic surgery is... it's really a subcategory of plastic surgery. So cosmetic or aesthetic surgery is sort of a super subspecialty that is generally outside of insurance coverage and things like that, all for cosmetic purposes. And, it's making a normal person mm-hmm. feel better about their appearance, whereas reconstructive surgery is taking something that's become abnormal, whether it's because of cancer or because of a war wound or a gunshot injury or removal of something, and making it back to normal.
So what kind of plastic surgery, did your father specialize in any kind of plastic surgery?
My dad was in his heyday, he was actually the chairman of plastic surgery at Medical College of Wisconsin, which is where I ended up going to medical school. And he was kind of in his heyday at the when microsurgery first came into being. So he did a lot of microsurgery and a lot of hand surgery. So he was mostly a reconstructive surgeon. Later in his life, he left the school and got a more elective practice and then did some cosmetic surgery.
And you knew you wanted to be a surgeon really early on. What inspired that? Tell me about that.
I did. I have one of those little books that you write down who's your best friend in first grade, and you put your little school pictures in, and what do you want to be when you grow up? And in my first grade folder, it says I wanted to be a doctor, D-O-T-E-R. And as far as I knew, all doctors were surgeons. That was just my realm of understanding of what a doctor was. I remember finding out that my pediatrician couldn't or didn't operate on people and thinking, oh my word, what'd he do? bless his heart. Why would you ever be a doctor and not operate on people? So my point of reference was very much surgical, and I used to ask my dad when he came home, what'd you do today? And show me pictures, and I would look at his books, and I would look at the cleft lip and palate stuff and the craniofacial reconstruction, and I just was always fascinated by it. I can still smell those old books.
I know your daughter, Katie, I know she came and watched my surgery when she was in high school. Did you get to go watch your father's surgery at all as a kid?
I did. Actually, the first case I went to see was my uncle, who is also an MD-DDS, and he was doing a big Lafort fracture, which is basically a mid-face fracture, kind of cheekbone type thing. And so it was a really gnarly surgery.
Yeah.
My dad put me in.
How old were you?
I was probably early high school. It wasn't okay. as regulated as it is now.
Yeah.
But it was pretty mind blowing.
That's neat. And so where did you go to college?
I went to Boston College. Boston, I grew up okay. in Milwaukee, and I went to public school, and I went to Boston College for undergrad mm-hmm. and loved, you know, the experience of being away. And then I came back to Milwaukee for medical school. So I got into Medical College of Wisconsin. I went early decision because I wanted to be able to live at home. Mm-hmm. And so I came back to Medical College of Wisconsin, which is in Milwaukee. And I lived in my childhood house growing up and where I grew up. And the school was, you know, a couple miles away. And so it was convenient, cost effective. And my dad didn't live at home then. So I lived with my mom, and it was great.
What was the percentage? I'm curious. I don't know what years you went to college, and you don't have to reveal it, or medical college. You don't have to reveal it if you don't want to.
I'm happy to.
But back then, what was the percentage of women in medical school versus men?
There were 7% women in my class.
Wow.
So it was, we were definitely a minority. And I never, a lot of people have nightmare stories about discrimination and, you know, not being able to get through the glass ceiling. I had amazing mentors all along my training. Of course, my dad was my original mentor, and he was always extremely supportive of me going to medical school and becoming a surgeon. I mean, I went to medical school to become a surgeon, mm-hmm. no doubt, which is kind of interesting if you want to get really sort of deep and fluffy about it. My parents were of a different generation, and women didn't really work. I mean, mm-hmm. my dad didn't want my mom to work, and their marriage did fail after 25 years. And part of it was my mom was very bright, very motivated, you know, worked before kids, but then you gave up your job to raise your children. That's what you did. And she was mm-hmm. a great mom, and she raised 5 children and then was kind of ready to go back to work. And my dad was not supportive of it. And yet he was extremely supportive of me going to medical school and becoming a surgeon. So it was a double standard that was a little bit confusing to me, but it wasn't even really that questioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny.
That is funny.
So anyway, both my parents were supportive of me. And like I said, I always knew I wanted to be not just a surgeon. I wanted to be a plastic surgeon.
Yeah. And that's where you met Dr. Hawes, right? Y'all met in medical school, right?
We met. She was in medical school and I was in residency. My husband and I met. My husband was in my class at Wisconsin, and we were freshmen together. We met freshman year and started dating. So we dated all the way through medical school. And then we actually went through the couples match, which is this big computer in the sky that tells you where you're going to go do your residency. So you can do it as a couple. So I matched for general surgery and he matched for orthopedic surgery. So we ended up at Southern Illinois University, where Dr. Hawes was a third-year medical student, and we were first-year surgery interns. And actually, July 1st, that would have been 1989, my husband was on general surgery, and Mindy was on general surgery and was the medical student. So they were very much the blind leading the blind.
Oh, my gosh. That's funny.
You don't want to get sick July 1st.
So what's your favorite surgery to do? Like, what do you enjoy the most?
It's hard. What's beautiful about plastic surgery is, even though I do now the same, you know, 10 to 15 surgeries for the most part, if you had to categorize it, every single patient's different and every body is like a work of art. And so it's continues to be challenging every single case. I enjoy breast and body contouring.
Mm-hmm.
That's really my love. It's very much like sculpting, and, you know, artwork on some levels. It's just my medium is the human body. And breasts are very three-dimensional, and well, I mean, bodies and faces are too, but it's an organ that is all very close to all of our hearts, and there's a lot of body image overtones and sexual overtones and all those kinds of things with breast surgery that makes it just extremely rewarding.
Yeah. So what, okay, so let's move into some of the questions we got, because I feel like we have quite a few to get through. So I want to do the surgery questions first, and then we've got some about injectables. So this was a popular question, like, what is a mommy makeover?
That's a great question. And there's not really any blue plate special that's exactly what a mommy makeover is. It's really any plastic surgery, oftentimes a combination of procedures that a woman has after she's done with childbearing, when, you know, she's seeing some of the effects of having children. And as many of us know, having children can be very hard on your body. So you certainly go through a lot of changes. Most of those changes tend to be in the breast and tummy area. Certainly, I would say breast lift, breast augmentation, sometimes breast reductions, combinations of those procedures are the most common breast procedures. And then tummy can be, is most often a tummy tuck. That's often kind of the main procedure of a mommy makeover, but not necessarily. Some women get through childbearing and their tummy doesn't need a tummy tuck by any stretch of the imagination, but both the muscles can get stretched out and the skin can get stretched out. So it is a common, especially after multiple pregnancies or twin or triplet even pregnancies. But you know, it sometimes can be women that have just had big weight fluctuations. You know, if they're a mommy, it gets put in the mommy makeover category. If they're not a mommy, it gets put in, you know, it gets called something different. But generally speaking, it's, you know, either tightening things up or remodeling, so to speak, after some of the ravages of pregnancy.
Well, and circling back to the muscle separation, is that always surgical? Can the muscles ever come back together? Does it depend on how severe it is?
That's a good question. I think a lot of that depends on your genetics and your particular anatomy, and maybe even kind of where your muscles sit relative to your pubic bone and your xiphoid process. And a lot of it, as you know from your work, has to do with collagen and how tight or taut or stretchy your muscles or your soft tissues are. So muscle separation occurs so that the uterus can grow forward, and the rectus muscles are the six-pack muscles. There's two muscles. They're a pair, and they go straight down the middle, and your belly button's sort of in the middle. And in order to accommodate a growing, really pretty quickly growing uterus, those muscles will pull to the side when the uterus grows straight forward. And in some women, after the pregnancy, those muscles just slurp right back and go right parallel again in the middle. And in other women, they never go back. And there is a wide separation that stays that can be improved with surgery. Oftentimes, they kind of get a little further and further apart with multiple pregnancies, certainly with twin pregnancies. But I've seen women who've had twin pregnancies and they don't have a muscle separation. So is there anything you can do to improve your muscle separation aside from surgery? Strengthening your muscles does help. It's not going to close a gap if a gap is there, but if you think about a rubber band stretching out, that's kind of what happens to the muscle wall in general of the whole, you know, belly wall. And if you really work out your core muscles, especially your abdominals, core, of course, is circumferential. But if you really work out your core muscles, you can, this is an oversimplification, but you can actually improve this, the tautness of that rubber band. So you can flatten your belly quite a bit with muscle tightening, but I mean, with core strengthening, but you can't, there's no amount of sit-ups or not doing sit-ups that will close a gap if that gap is there, say 6 months or a year after. I've heard theories that women who try to do sit-ups too early are more likely to have a separation. I have no idea if that's true. My OB told me that, and she said, you know, just let yourself heal. Give yourself 6 months before you start going psycho on on trying to strengthen your core, because you need to let everything heal as much as it's going to on its own. Then you can start strengthening those core muscles. And I was happy to have any excuse not to do a sit-up. So,
well, outside of sit-ups, what kind of core exercise, like, what do you think is good for core exercises?
Well, there's a lot of options now. The bar, classes, and yoga is great for core strengthening. Yeah. I mean, I tell people after a tummy tuck, when I do repair those muscles and tighten them back together, I do not ask them not to do any core strengthening sit-ups, especially, real crunch burpees and crunches and things like that for 3 months.
Wow.
But I want them starting to exercise as soon as 2 weeks after surgery. But the reason for that is the only thing that's holding those muscles together is the permanent sutures. And we rely on those stitches, the scar tissue healing together.
Yeah.
And if you're doing too much core before that scar tissue has matured, you're going to pull apart the repair. So at 3 months, what I have people do is start with planking, because planking is isometric core.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great strength training. It's great for your core. It's great for a circumferential, your back muscles and your abdominal muscles. So I generally, because you're also going to be a little out of shape after 3 months of not doing any of protecting your cores.
Yeah.
So I have people start with planking, and that seems to be well tolerated, and then work back into, you're going to be able to do burpees and crunches and stuff 6-12 months down the line, but you have to kind of protect that abdominal repair, muscle repair in the
right
early healing.
And 2 weeks, isn't that about the downtime you would say for a surgery, like a tummy tuck?
That's another great question, and is a common question that people come in. And that is probably one of the hardest things about my job, is predicting downtime, because I can't touch somebody's belly. I can't feel their skin. I can't talk to them and be able to tell how they're going to feel discomfort. Surgeons never say pain. They always say discomfort. So it's downtime is variable. It's real variable. Like, for instance, for a breast augmentation, the bell-shaped curve, so to speak, of people's downtime or how long they hurt is very sharp. It's very, it's 2 or 3 days that it really hurts, and then people get better, and most people are pretty close to the same. A tummy tuck, on the other hand, has a very wide bell-shaped curve, because people are all over the place as far as how much discomfort they have. It's a bigger operation than a breast augmentation by a long shot. I tell people it'll be 2 weeks before you're back to a desk job if we are tightening their muscle. If we don't tighten their muscle, which everyone doesn't need their muscle tightened. Some people just have loose skin and don't have loose muscle.
Yeah.
And if it's not going to help them, I don't want to hurt them more or make their downtime more if they're not going to get a cosmetic improvement from it. So the average person will tell them you probably need to arrange 2 weeks off work if it's kind of a desk job or doesn't require a lot of manual labor. Things like, waitressing or wait staffing or, machinery work or things where you have to do heavy lifting, you probably need to take a little bit more time off to protect that core. But the average person can go back to a desk job. They can drive themselves to and from work, but you're tired. It's just, it's exhausting. Surgery takes a lot of energy to heal, and it does, you're not going to be 100% at 2 weeks. I do strongly encourage people to exercise sooner than later, especially if they're on a weight loss journey, they've lost a lot of weight, then they have surgery and don't do anything for 3 months, they're going to gain weight. Like, duh.
Yeah.
So I try to get people at least walking, even if it's just walking on the treadmill. You can start getting your heart rate up, depending what combination of procedures you have, but you can often start getting your heart rate up as soon as 2 weeks after surgery, just to, for weight maintenance and not to get too far behind the eight ball with losing what you've worked hard for muscle-wise.
Yeah, well, and another thing that the nurses told me at my pre-op that I didn't know about healing was they were really recommending eating a lot of protein.
Yeah, protein is important. Especially people who've been dieting to lose weight before surgery or come to see me once they've lost a lot of surgery. It's really important that you have a good protein base, and I recommend during the healing period a higher protein, lower carb diet just for healing. Definitely don't want to be vitamin deficient, so taking a multivitamin.
Yeah.
And probably with iron, especially bigger surgeries like tummy tucks or body lifts or things like that, we do lose a little bit of blood, so you want to beef that hematocrit up.
Like I know we joke sometimes that like I'm our practice manager Whitney used to say, like, I'm the gateway drug to this office. Mm-hmm. Like people a lot of times, if they're scared or nervous about plastic surgery, they'll just come in and see me for a facial.
Right.
And they kind of talk to me, they feel me out, and then the next appointment they're asking about Botox, and then a few months later into that, like, what do you know about tummy tucks?
Yeah.
And I do try and tell them, you know, as much as I can and about my experience with my surgery, but also like let them know, like, try and be in good shape ahead of time, like taking your multivitamins, be getting some exercise, maybe up your protein intake, just to be as healthy as possible.
Right.
Going
into
it.
Recovery is by and large, there's exceptions to every rule, but by and large, the people who are in good physical condition and are exercising pretty regularly recover faster.
Right.
Absolutely, hands down. So it is good. And the older I get, I mean, I'm 57 years old now, and I have been through menopause, been on both sides of that. I've had surgery. I've had most of my procedures before menopause, but it's important to take care of yourself. I wish I would have been better about exercising. I wish I would have been better about staying out of the sun, even though I knew. But if, you know, these things are real, what your mother told you actually does matter.
Okay, another question we had about surgery was, how often do breast implants need to be replaced?
Ooh, another good question. So my general recommendation, and I talk to all my patients about this, is if they don't bother you, don't bother them.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, a lot of women will come in, and they might even, I didn't put in their implants, they might have had their implants put in someplace else, and they come in at, they're at 10 years or they're at 20 years, and they say, well, my doctor told me I was supposed to get them replaced every 10 years or every 20 years. There's really no reason to get them replaced if they're holding up. So how can you tell if your implants are holding up? Well, if you have saline implants, if they remain filled, then they're holding up. If you have silicone implants, you can get an ultrasound, you can get a mammogram, which you know, most of the time, if you've had them 20 years, if you were 20 when you got them, you're 40, you're getting mammograms anyway. So what I tell people is I teach everybody how to do self breast exam. I recommend that they get their mammograms according to regular schedule. A mammogram can be as high as 88% sensitive for picking up a rupture of a silicone implant. It's not perfect, and that probably is estimating a little bit high, but it can show abnormalities, and it's always good to keep up with your mammograms anyway. Ultrasound is probably becoming the easiest way to pick up a rupture.
Yeah.
So if you do have a rupture, you need to get it changed. I've had my implants 17 years. I have silicone gel. I go my mammograms once a year. I keep my finger on the pulse, so to speak. Every single morning when I'm just washing and I'm in the shower, I move my implants around. I think it's important to keep in touch with your breast implants. You should be able to notice if something has changed. And you should do self-breast exam once a month right after your period. If you don't get your period anymore, you should do it once a month when you pay your mortgage, or once a month when you do something once
right.
a month. But it can be life-saving. It's absolutely imperative. So there is some maintenance with breast implants, but they don't expire. They don't expire at 10 years. They don't expire at 20 years. But there are ways to kind of image them, feel them through the skin. If you're not, you should see somebody who knows about breast implants, preferably your plastic surgeon that put them in. I'd like to see my patients once a year.
Mm-hmm.
I would say you get 5-10 years out, they're not coming once a year. They don't really want to deal with it. But every couple years, and a lot of my patients will do that. I just, you know, I got my first mammogram. I wanted to make sure everything felt okay. And
yeah, and we offer ultrasound here for our patients.
We do.
So that's really
nice.
That's
been a huge, I love our ultrasound machine. And we are not... you know, certified professional ultrasonographers, but as far as just looking at that implant shell integrity, it's a really nice window into what's going on in there. It also is a great way to tell if somebody has fluid around their implant, which, you know, some of the problems that can arise very late with breast implants can mm-hmm. present with fluid around the implant. So it's a great tool. It's a great way to just kind of get a peek at what's going in there. Another reason to see your doctor is if your breast implants get firm or hard. And I think if you're staying in touch with your breasts and doing self breast exam and moving the implants around, you're going to notice if one side or both sides start getting firmer, and that can be painful. It can distort the breast, and so those are reasons to see someone sooner than later.
And then another question we got is, what kind of questions did you ask your plastic surgeon at like an implant consult, or I would think just a consult in general? I mean, I know half the time I go to the doctor and I'm just like, yes, I'm fine. Like, I forget any questions. So
I would say write them down ahead of time, for one thing. Women are coming in so well educated now because of the internet, and it really is a big difference. I can tell they've researched. I can tell, you know, these are smart people that know their stuff. Every once in a while, someone's coming in, they're just kind of fishing around, just kind of see what it's all about, and really haven't done a lot of research yet. And we will just sort of start off feel out where they are and what kind of information they need. I think it's very important that you go to a board certified plastic surgeon who's experienced.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, I'm not saying there aren't less experienced people who are great surgeons, but this is something, you know, I've been doing for 25 years, and I've learned a lot over 25 years. I'm a better surgeon than I was 25 years ago. I have no doubt about that. So go to somebody who's got experience, mm-hmm. that this isn't just something they do, you know, once a month or a couple times a year or something like that. And as my practice has evolved, like, I stopped doing rhinoplasty because I was doing it once a month or every couple months. And mm-hmm. it's something that you need to be doing frequently to be doing a good enough job to take someone's nose into your hands. So, you know, I just stopped doing those things and doing rhinoplasties.
Yeah, ask them about their board certifications. Make sure they're a plastic surgeon.
Absolutely. Make sure they're a plastic surgeon. Just because they advertise plastic surgeon doesn't mean they're board certified in plastic surgery.
Right.
And just because they're board certified doesn't mean they're board certified in plastic surgery. So be sure to look at what their credentials are. What board are they certified by? You want them to be certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery, not the American Board of Cosmetic Surgery or some fly-by-night board that's made up.
Yes.
And then, you know, you want to ask, where do they operate? Are they in a fully certified operating room? That's critical. You don't want to be, you know, in the garage, I'm exaggerating, but you want mm-hmm. to be in absolutely a fully Quad A certified operating room setting, especially when implants are involved. You want to ask about the anesthesiologist. Do you use an anesthesiologist? Do you use an anesthetist? Anesthetists are great, if they're experienced. Some of the private offices that have ORs in their office use an anesthetist only and do a great job. But, you know, what's the backup? If something goes wrong, where are we going to go? I only operate in hospital-associated operating rooms. It's just where my comfort level is right now, and so far I've been able to get away with that. I really like to be able to be at peace that I can do my craft and let the anesthesiologist take care of the patient being asleep. So I feel like I don't want to have to be doing their monitoring or doing any part of their anesthesia.
I never thought about that. Like, people that have their own operating rooms, the doctors are responsible for monitoring it to an extent.
If it's an anesthetist, you've got somebody who's dedicated to taking care of them. But if you just have an RN who's pushing the drugs, you know, you are absolutely responsible for that person's safety and how asleep they are and, you know, all those kinds of things. So I prefer to operate in a fully equipped, where the emergency room or if something, God forbid, somebody had, hyperthermia or some anesthesia complication, God forbid, never had it happen. I've got to find some wood to knock on. But I just like to have belt and suspenders.
That's funny because just like a small story about me and my childhood and background, my dad's an attorney. He was a defense attorney. He defended hospitals, grocery stores. So growing up at the dinner table, the stories I heard is anesthesia. Like I thought it was almost like putting humans to sleep. Like I kind of, and I know now it's more rare, but as a kid, it seemed more common to me. And I was really scared growing up of like having to have surgery or anesthesia because my dad's cases that I heard about were the
things had gone wrong.
Yeah, things had gone wrong.
Right.
So that's
the other important thing about office-based surgery is it's really important to do your homework on your doctor because some people are operating in their office because they are not certified to have privileges at the hospital.
Ooh.
So it is absolutely not insulting to ask those, demand those credentials. Like, is your operating room certified? Because those certifications are very hard to get and hard to maintain. So you have to really have a state-of-the-art equipment and you have to have all the crash carts and mm-hmm. all the backup and people have to be trained in the office that are there.
Yeah.
And if those things aren't, all those boxes aren't checked, you're not going to get your certification.
That's scary. Okay. So the next question, I think that's all of the surgery questions. Everything else is going to be Botox and filler. So someone wanted to know, what are the long-term effects of Botox and filler?
The long-term effects of Botox and filler are pretty much all positive. So the person who gets the most out of Botox over time is the person who starts relatively early. Because it's going to keep those wrinkles from ever getting ingrained in your skin. So if you start doing Botox in your 60s and you've had a lot of sun damage and you've already got deeply ingrained wrinkles in your forehead or around in your crow's feet or your number 11 lines between your eyebrows, the Botox is going to do less for you than it is if you start in your 30s or even 40s before those wrinkles are part of your skin anatomy. So somebody who starts earlier than later is going to keep the knife away longer. So
I've heard, I think there's this myth in this industry because I see this in magazines and it always peeves me when I see it repeated, but there's a myth that like filler over time is going to stretch out your skin. What do you think about that?
No, it would have to be done really improperly to stretch out your skin. I mean, some filler, I don't want to see the filler. I'm offended by filler that you can see. You shouldn't be able to see it. It should be making you look normal, not making you look abnormal.
Right.
So filler can and should be working sort of in the background so that you can't see it necessarily. I mean, there are people that have really small lips that need their lips plumped up and you're going to see that, but you shouldn't be able to tell. I mean, ideally you don't want to be able to tell. It should look natural. I get some fillers in my face and as we age, our faces deflate. The subcutaneous fat, so the sort of underlying normal fat that's underneath our skin, that's why we get those fine wrinkles and why old ladies have wrinkly arms, and is because that fine layer of fat that's right underneath the skin just deflates over time. And that's happening in our face, it's happening in our bones, and that's all about collagen. But those deflation is one of the cardinal sort of signs of aging. So what fillers do is it sort of camouflages that deflation.
Yes. And then the myth I see about Botox and what I see also kind of debated sometimes is that Botox is going to affect your muscles negatively long term.
That's an interesting claim. Botox is very, one of the problems is it doesn't last forever. Like everybody wants Botox that lasts forever once you, and everybody wants filler that lasts forever. But I always tell people, you need to know your injector, whoever mm-hmm. that is. Here we have RN injectors who are far better at injecting than I am. Mm-hmm. I'm far better at surgery, and so we should just both do what we're good at. So the injector, you want to really know that injector knows and that you know where that filler is before you have some of the more permanent fillers put in. So start with the shorter acting fillers, get a good relationship with your injector, and really know before you start putting the longer acting fillers in. And also the hyaluronic acids are dissolvable. Yep. So if you don't have a good result or you're unhappy with it or you think it makes you look funny or weird, you just dissolve it.
That's great. And that kind of covers that second question, which was someone had asked about the longer term. Like I know there's a newer Botox that's coming on the market that lasts longer, and then some of the fillers that last longer. And that's what our nurse injectors say. And they don't currently work with those because, I mean, some of them can last 3 to 5 years. And if you don't like your results and you can't dissolve it, like the one I'm thinking of, Sculptra in particular, you can't dissolve it. It's just got to wear off. If you don't like it, you're stuck with those results.
The ones that are more dangerous, I hate to use the word dangerous, but some of the ones that are more, they're calcium based, and mm-hmm. so they're firmer. They can be great for the right person, but you want to know damn well that it's going to go where you want it. Also, one of the things about the long-lasting fillers is my face sure as hell looks different now than it did 5 years ago. So is that filler, even if the filler does what it's supposed to and stays exactly where it was, which filler doesn't necessarily stay exactly where it was put, it might not be in the right place 5 years later when your skin starts to descend. So to me, I think the longer lasting is good. I certainly would love Botox to last longer, and I think there will be some longer lasting Botox or neurotoxin, I should say neurotoxin, because there's many different kinds of neurotoxin. There's Botox, there's Xeomin, there's
Jeuveau, Dysport.
And Dysport are the main four. And they all have little pluses and minuses. All work great. All work by the exact same mechanism of action. They only work in the muscle that they're injected into. So they're acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. So they keep the muscle from contracting. But your body sort of figures it out and starts making new receptors. Right. And that's why it only lasts 3 to 4 months.
That's an interesting point about the permanent fillers that I never thought about, that your face may move, because I tell women all the time during hydrofacials that they ask me about cosmetic brow tattooing, like, and I'm not talking about microblading, which is semi-permanent, which is why I like it, but I never thought cosmetic tattooing of your eyebrows was a good idea, because that's permanent, and like you said, your face isn't going to be, so your brows can end up in your eyelids.
And styles change, too.
Well, I mean, that's huge.
You know, if you look at what the styles were 20 years ago, they're different than they are today. So I think eyebrow tattooing can be fabulous for some people, especially that don't have any eyebrow hairs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be hard, and I think tattooing is great. It does require some maintenance. As you know, tattoos fade over time and styles change. But if you have no eyebrows, tattooing is pretty great. If you have some of your own eyebrows, I think maximizing and a little eyebrow pencil is not a bad idea.
And then someone asked about under eye filler. How, like, what's the maintenance? Can you just do it once and that's it?
Almost very few fillers are one and done. Another good question. I would say the biggest thing about under eye filler is to have an expert varsity level injector. That is not something that should be done by a casual injector or somebody who does mostly Botox and does a little bit of filler. Under eye filler does have potential complications, and if that filler finds its way into a blood vessel, it can cause even vision problems. So it's extremely important that it is done by an experienced person. It's also best done working your way into it, not blowing too much in there at once. But it can be, for the right person, really, really give a phenomenal improvement, and again, can keep the knife away.
Speaking of the why you need such an experienced injector, that makes me want to ask how you feel about, I know a lot of people are doing non-surgical nose jobs with fillers. Oh, yeah. How do you feel about that?
I have seen some really impressive results, I have to say.
Yeah.
It is, I think, again, it has to be an experienced person, but I think there's something to it for sure.
Yeah.
I think it depends what your problem is. If you have a big dorsal hump, which is a big hump on your nose, filler is not going to camouflage that. Or,
yeah,
you know, you need a bony rhinoplasty and you need your bones broken and it's going to bruise and it's going to take a long time to heal. But it's life changing. I mean, huge, can be a huge difference. If you've got some little, especially if you've had a previous rhinoplasty and maybe have some little imperfection or abnormality that is a little asymmetric, filler, it can be huge improvement. And I think a lot of it depends too on how thick your skin is. So some people who have really heavy skin, bigger pores, are going to get less improvement than somebody with a little bit thinner overlying soft tissue coverage.
Yeah.
So I think it has to be done. That question has to be answered sort of on an individual basis. But overall, I'm really following it carefully. I've seen some great results, but it also has some potential complications too for filler getting in the wrong place.
Right.
And I definitely think you want to go with dissolvable fillers.
Yes.
You know, sitting right in the middle of your face.
Speaking of dissolvable things, sutures are back. Facelift with sutures,
yeah,
the thread lifts.
Right.
We saw those at the meeting in New York when we were there. We saw like a live video of it, and I'm seeing it get more and more popular. How do you feel about thread facelifts?
I've been very conservative with that because I tend to see people in my practice who've had that on the outside by maybe not non-surgical people who can't do facelifts or whatever, and they've had problems. And so I've seen a little bit of a skewed population. So that does affect what I feel about it. I have seen some animation deformities. So when people smile, they get funny redraping of their skin. I think it's a good temporizing measure. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably has some great merit for people that are kind of my age, you know, 55 to 60, that aren't, you know, either can't find the time to have a facelift or can't quite justify it cost-wise or don't have the downtime. I think you can maybe get a couple of years of improvement, but the results are definitely more subtle than a facelift. But sometimes subtle is great. So
yeah.
I'm following it. They've gotten better. The original barbed sutures were, there were some problems.
Yeah. I've been, it is interesting. And I think it can be a good solution for, like you said, women who like aren't ready maybe to go in, who just have some subtle sagging, just to kind of tack that up, maybe keep it there for 5-10 years until they're ready to go under the knife.
It probably isn't going to last 5-10
no?
years.
Okay.
It probably isn't. I mean, I think it's more in the 1 to max 3, but
I didn't realize it was that temporary.
I mean, it just can only pull so much.
I guess,
you know,
yeah, that's true.
And again, there's some new stuff on the horizon that I haven't looked into yet. So
yeah, that's the fun thing about
better.
Like our field is that there's always new things
always
coming
new
out.
Things. Yeah.
There, things are always changing. Guidelines are changing. It's a really fun field to work in and really fulfilling.
I had somebody say I had a consult this morning actually, and it was a gentleman, and I don't do as many male facelifts as female facelifts, but he came in and he was, you know, just asking questions about tightening up the skin, and he had very realistic expectations. Super nice guy, was in his 60s, and he said, well, I'm just going to go to work the next day, or I'm going to go to work, you know, within a couple days, because I don't care if anybody knows. And, you know, we talked about that, but he said, well, of all times to have a facelift, now's the time, because you just put a mask on.
That's right.
I'm like, wow, you're right.
I mean, that's, I keep joking with people about that in terms of like getting a chemical peel.
It's a great time to get a chemical peel
because half of your face is hidden. Right. And same thing with fillers. It's so easy right now to hide all that bruising. Yeah. I mean, I got fillers, you know, I clocked out the other day at lunch, got fillers, bruised up, swollen, puffy, threw a mask on, saw my afternoon patients.
No one knew.
It was beautiful.
I just got some fillers the other day. I got no bruising at all. So it just depends. Some days are better than others. I do think you do have to be a little bit careful. If you're someone who has to be in a mask all day long with a chemical peel, probably isn't great, because I think there's going to be more bacteria that can kind of hover in there. So I do think you have to talk to your practitioner about that and what your mask requirements are, because now, you know, we're wearing a mask all day.
Yes.
I can't wait to get in my car and rip that mask off. But it's, you know, that may enter into the equation.
I am having that conversation with my chemical peels. First of all, they get a fresh mask when they leave after almost all procedures, because we're worried about staff living in your old mask. Right. So everyone should be washing their mask, replacing their masks. And then when I did a peel on myself the other week, and I was changing it twice a day to a fresh mask to keep, like you said, the bacteria and all. But it went very smoothly because I was a little worried with the mask. Am I going to get some blowback? Am I going to have a little breakout? Out, right. But it went really smoothly. So
you know, I think I might have you do a peel on me. now that we talk about this.
And I think that wraps up all of the questions. So unless you have anything else you wanted to add in, that will wrap it
up. We can always come back.
Yeah, we can always come back if y'all have more questions and do another session. But thanks so much for sitting down and talking with me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for taking the time to listen. We want to thank Kelsey Kopecki for letting us use her music and Damian Churchwell for the sound engineering. Please leave us a review, throw us some stars, and subscribe.